to Behind the Screams. As always, my name is Ian. This is episode number 115, and in today's show, we are covering the 2005 movie Wolf Creek. But I am not alone today. I am joined by a returning special guest to the show. They were on our previous episode where we talked about Ma. Please say a big, big welcome back to Jade. How's it going?
Hey, it's going really well. You know, I'm feeling pumped about this, real fired up with our COVID conversation before we started recording, you know, so I'm ready to go.
For those listening, I got Jade really mad.
I mean, just those things about like precautions in the middle of a quarantine that you feel shouldn't have to be said, and yet you do, and you just get so frustrated when you see the people of Walmart. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I do. I suffered those people just a couple of days ago, as I was telling you. So, yes, but we'll calm the COVID chat.
I'm like, let's not get back into this again.
we'll do the entire hour podcast just on the COVID chat, and I'm not sure that the listeners are quite ready for it. You know, we might spit some fire in that instance.
How are we going to tie this into Wolf Creek?
They don't seem to take any COVID precautions in this movie, you know.
We weren't in a pandemic in 2005 either, so...
Well, that's true. That's true. You know what? You've got me there. but Jade, for those who don't know, or some may know you better as Coyote Wildfire on Twitch and Twitter... you are obviously a Twitch streamer. Do you want to, number one, tell our listeners where they can find you across your social medias, and tell us a little bit about your Twitch channel?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll try to keep it brief. It's kind of difficult to capture 6 years worth of my Twitch journey, as it were, in a very short span of time. But you can find me twitch.tv/coyotewildfire. My typical schedule is Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern time. We have a Discord. You can follow me on Twitter as well for updates, or just Google Coyote Wildfire and you'll find far more information than you ever wanted to know about me. But the typical idea that I try to embrace and embody is just building connections with people, building community, and not just like arbitrary sense of support and community like you see in a lot of streamer circles. Like, I really want to connect with my community and be a present part of their lives, because I have some people, you know, they've been with me since they were 15, and you know, now they're going to college. So that sort of a thing is the connections and the conversations and the memories is 100% what we want. And you know, when you're in my stream, I want you to feel like you're coming home.
Yeah, that's so awesome. And you know what, it's one of the reasons why back in the day when we first had you on the podcast, it feels like such a long time ago, one of the reasons that I had you on the podcast at the time, so I felt like we had very similar sort of values in terms of, you know, wanting to build communities and wanting to have those interactions with people. One of the values that, you know, that I pride myself on with this show is, you know, our interaction with the people who listen to us, you know, and I spend an incredible amount of time of my life just on social medias, which, as you well know, Jade, can be incredibly, you know, challenging and difficult and time consuming, and, you know, at times can be very, you know, have negative impacts on things like your mental health or whatever else. You know, I really, really do try absolute hardest to spend so much time all across these interacting with people, making those connections. And that's one of the reasons why when I asked you on the show originally to do Ma, that's why I asked you. And, you know, I think that's really, really awesome, because like you say, it's something that there's other people who also have incredible interaction with their communities, you know, and making those connections. But unfortunately, it is something that you see maybe just a little bit too often, isn't it?
It's unfortunate, because to reduce your community to just numbers, whether it's, you know, numbers of viewers or the amount of money that you earn from them, mm-hmm. You know, really reduces and robs you of your experience, like the amount of quality that you could get out of it. It's such an enriching feeling to really be a part of and a present part of your community's lives. Like I started streaming because I wanted to take something that I was doing ordinarily. I'd be gaming anyway, right? And just put it out there on the off chance that, you know, someone might find this random, you know, long-haired dude screaming at his camera, right? You know, and if there was that opportunity that presented itself, to be vigilant, to be able to take it, because I believe very strongly in the power of the small act of kindness and what a difference that can make in somebody's life. Yes. So that when somebody comes into my channel, I want them to bring them their whole selves, like bring who they are, that they shouldn't have to feel like they have to hide it. Absolutely. And those communications, those connections, those opportunities that I have has been such, bar none, I mean, the most enriching part of my life and creative endeavor. And I encourage, you know, anybody who's like-minded to, you know, just remember that and what value each and every life, you know, has.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I can honestly say, you know, I don't always have time, a lot of time, a free time to go around, especially with sort of Twitch streams. I do try my best to, you know, drop into as many people's streams as I possibly can, but I can honestly say anytime I've ever went into one of your streams or into one of Laurie's streams, you know, you always make me feel incredibly welcome, which is sometimes such a big thing. Like you say, it's just a small case of taking the time to, you know, when we say hello to, you know, you such a genuine reaction. You're so happy to see people, and that's a nice thing to be felt as well. So you know, that's such a big thing for us. And it's funny you say, you know, because like you said, so many people are out here, you know, to try and they think, oh well, I can just make a quick buck, and they focus on the numbers and the money. And the laugh of it is, if you have these genuine interactions and you go into it with this mindset, people are so much more willing to support you anyway. You know. You know, because you're genuine and you're being real rather than one of these people. If you're all about the money, people will pick up that you are all about the money, and that's just not going to work for you. So absolutely not. So yeah, I completely agree with you there. But so did you tell people where to find you? Yeah, you did.
Yes, I did. Yep. Coyote Wildfire. Just Google it. You'll find me.
Absolutely. Don't forget, it's my plugs that I hadn't done.
That's it. See, we missed it.
You can find this podcast on Twitter at Screams Behind. Facebook and Instagram, just search for Behind the Screams podcast and you will find us. If you would like to support us, we've got a whole host of bonus extra content and perks over on our Patreon page, patreon.com/behindthescreams. You can sign up from just £1 a month. And on our Patreon page, you can get access to four bonus episodes per month, although we've uploaded 5 episodes in the month of February. You get early access to all of our Wednesday episodes. We've started uploading the video feed for our Wednesday recordings. You get merchandise. You know, there's a whole host of things on there. So if you have listened to the main show and you would like to support us and help us, you know, keep paying the bills, patreon.com/behindthescreams, you can do that there. Finally,
do it. I will send McTaylor after you. Just do it.
No one wants that. As Jade mentioned, I think a little bit earlier, we are also on Twitch now as well. We are back. You know, I used to be a streamer. Nowhere near as good as you, my friend, I must say, back in the day. But we are back. We are back on Twitch. We stream 4 nights a week. You have got Dave, or if you know him on social medias, you'll probably know him better as Wookie. He streams for us on Saturdays, our spooky Saturday streams, and then I stream on Sundays, Mondays, and Wednesdays. And we play a whole variety of horror video games. So on Saturday, Dave just streamed Outlast 2, and then I've been streaming a combination of Silent Hill 2, Dead by Daylight, and The Walking Dead as well. But, you know, we may start throwing in some non-horror streams as well, you know, because I might be getting the taste for just wanting to stream more general stuff too. So we'll see how that goes. But yes, that is twitch.tv/behindthescreamspodcast. You can go and support us there. But Jade, are you ready to talk about this movie?
Should I get some like burn cream?
pillow to hang behind. Just get a pillow to hang behind, yeah.
Okay, all right, okay. Great, thanks.
We are talking about Wolf Creek.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Captain's log. So far, no sign of intelligent life forms.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Looks like we might be spending the night.
What the hell?
Just stay in the car!
What the bloody hell are you mob doing out here? Scared the shit out of me.
So, where did you live?
Oh, I get around here. Never know where I might pop up.
What do you actually do?
Oh, I can tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
This movie was released in 2005, was written, directed, and produced by Greg McLean, and stars John Jarrett, Cassandra McGrath, and Nathan Phillips. The IMDb plot is as follows. Three backpackers stranded in the Australian outback are plunged inside a hellish nightmare of insufferable torture by a sadistic, psychopathic local. Okay, so Jade, when I first approached you about coming back onto the show, I can't remember, did I give you a list of movies to choose from, or did you pick this one? I can't actually remember.
Well, I picked it from the list you gave me.
You picked it from the list, that's right. So what made you pick Wolf Creek out of the list?
Basically, the one that I wanted to do, my wife was going to want to choose instead, so I decided to give her first pick.
You know where your bread is buttered. You always let the wife pick.
You know what? It's completely fine. The reason that I met you to begin with, I think, was because of The Underworld, which was a streamer community based around horror streamers to begin with. Yeah. And she, I helped her found that when she had the idea, and you know, a couple of other people pitched in as well. And from there, like, you know, I've followed in her footsteps in many regards, and it brought. You know, it brought us together to begin with. And now, you know, friends like Lulu, for instance, and Wookiee, by proxy, and I can guarantee you they've become lifelong friends. So at the very least, I think I could give her first pick. Second pick, though, Wolf Creek was one that I watched with her as well. She introduced me to, and I watched it the first time, and I was so struck by it. Because of, you know, some of the scenes in particular kind of left a mark on me, but also the villain itself. And I think what attracted me to it was we had kind of a philosophical discussion quite a bit with Ma, and really getting into like the personality of Ma and what brought her to become the person that she was as in the movie. And I feel like there's a lot to discuss and unpack with regards to Mick as well.
Yeah.
And I love those sorts of philosophical and psychological discussions.
Absolutely.
As well as the content. I mean, it was a good movie.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, we'll jump about a bit back and forth here, because as you know, we're a little bit manic here. We don't just go chronologically. That's boring. I want to talk. One of the first things I really want to talk about in this movie, and it is Mick, because Mick is this I mean, first of all, being played by John Jarrett. John Jarrett does an absolutely amazing job in this movie, and in the subsequent movie and in the television series, and I believe we are getting a Wolf Creek 3 as well, so that's something else to really look forward to. Have you seen the sequels or the TV show?
I haven't seen the TV show, but I did see Wolf Creek 2, actually. Around the time that you and I started scheduling this episode was when I watched Wolf Creek 2. And I don't want to get too much into Wolf Creek 2 because obviously that's not what we're talking about. But I will say this. It made me want to go back and watch Wolf Creek again.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. I'm the same as you. I haven't seen the TV show. I still haven't seen the TV show because over here on our streaming services, it was season 2, but season 1 wasn't on our streaming services. But Shudder's just added it to our streaming services, so I'll be able to go and catch up with that. But yeah, so this movie really does center around this character of Mick. And one of the questions, because we post obviously daily questions and trivia things on our Twitter page especially, that I put out today, one of the questions I put out was what people think the most underrated horror villain is. In my opinion, Mick is absolutely one of the most underrated horror villains. Because, you know, when you're talking to someone about horror movies, you know, it's the same names that come up, isn't it? It's Michael Myers, it's Freddy Krueger, and I'll maybe get onto Freddy Krueger again in a little bit, because I feel like there's a couple of little similarities here, which sounds bizarre, but I have justification for it, I promise. But, you know, it's those, it's Jason, it's Ghostface, it's Pinhead, and don't get me wrong, I love all of these villains, but Mick really never gets talked about. And in my mind, Mick is potentially one of the most terrifying horror villains in horror cinema.
I find him extraordinarily sinister, and I think that we'll unpack a little bit more of his character, you know, as we go on with our discussion. But, you know, like you mentioned with all of these like slasher icons, and then you've got Mick, who I think would appeal to a lot more of those slasher types. You know, you've got this archetype of this villain that's pretty much unstoppable. He's going around killing people, like he just stalks them, right?
Yeah.
And then you have Mick, and Mick just hits a little bit different. He doesn't hit that archetype just quite so much, but in effect manages to do the same thing where he's just stalking, hunting, and killing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what really struck me is, and obviously I'd seen this movie, you know, multiple times before I rewatched it for this show, but even back when I was watching this for the first time, one of the things that really struck me about Mick was how much I liked him.
Hoping you'd say that. I'm sorry. I was hoping you'd say that. Okay.
No, but you know, he is so charismatic, you know. He's very, very charming as well, you know. He's funny, you know. He says some problematic things, don't get me wrong, but you know, he's funny, he's charismatic, you know. He appears to be very helping, and there's a genuine likeness, you just have that sort of some certain people, you know, when you meet them, you know, you just like them, you know, you can't quite put your finger on it, whether it's the aura about them or the way they carry themselves. You just sometimes have that opinion of people, you know, without really having any sort of justification behind it.
He has that, it's not approachability necessarily, but he does have that charisma, like you mentioned. He has that kind of personality that's really kind of winsome, which does lend to just how sinister he is, because you realize what a terrible human being he is. And he's just a characteristic sociopath in that regard. When he meets the characters for the first time, you know, like he seems really like really helpful. He says some problematic things, of course, and there's no justification for the terrible things that he does, but it's easy to understand why, like, oh yeah, of course they would just believe a random stranger where they're stranded. You know, the circumstances kind of suck and they don't have really many options, and this guy just comes along and he seems to have the answer to all their problems.
Yeah.
and then he's personable around, you know, like he's talking about, he's talking about, you know, you guys thirsty, you know, they're around a campfire, and he just talks about, oh, you know, rainwater straight from the top, you know, and like he's so likable. He's jovial. He's fun. Yes. He's funny.
Absolutely. And like you say, you know, they're sitting around a campfire, they're telling stories, they're cracking jokes, you know, they're having a burping contest at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, they're doing all of these things that you would do around a campfire with friends. You know, if you're sitting there, you've gone camping with friends and you've got a fire going in the night, you sit around and you tell stories and you do silly things, and you know, and so it almost felt like, you know, he was just part of the group anyway.
Mm-hmm. He definitely had that kind of moment, and I think that they did this for cinematic effect, where, you know, Ben cracks a joke and he, like, Mick stares him down, like, blank expression, and that was definitely tense, and I think that was the movie trying to cinematographically convey that, you know, like, okay, things are a little off, you know, like,
And going back and watching it, there's a couple of things, you know, that maybe I really didn't quite pick up on the first time in the words that he uses, specifically around this campfire scene as well. You know, he says things like, I think Ben asks him, you know, what he does for a living. And he's like, well, if I told you, then I'd have to kill you. And obviously that's in reference to the fact, well, if he told you that he goes around and murders tourists, then yeah, he would have to kill you. But the one that really got me is as well, he's telling the girls about, you know, I used to be a head shooter.
Yep.
You know, he used vermin. To clear the vermin. He would clear the pigs and the boars and things like that. And then he says this line. He says, "Oh, along the lines of, I kill a few kangaroos. I'm doing a favor for people. They're everywhere, like tourists." That's clearly, you know, if you know, he's actually mean that. He means that. That's so. The foreboding is there. The foreshadowing is there. But you might not pick up on it, especially upon a first watch. You know, you might just think that's a, you know, he's just cracking a joke. And obviously that's what the characters think. They think, oh, he's just making fun. He's making light of the things. No, he's being serious.
Right, because he had already disarmed them at that point by the cracking a joke. You know, he couldn't really take Mick seriously, and he didn't really seem to take himself too seriously either. We're all having a laugh, a little bit of banter here and there. And so he makes a lighthearted jab, or at least what appears to be a lighthearted jab, which has far more truth to it than they were anticipating.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's so much to, like you say, unpack with this character. And, you know, we're talking about him and how, you know, charismatic he is and things like that. And that is, as well, a very common trait of a serial killer. You know, you know, when you look at, especially, you know, some of the major serial killers throughout history, a lot of them were very charismatic people. They were very charming, and that's how they would lure their victims into whatever traps and whatever dastardly plans. Dastardly is maybe a bad word. That makes it sound like a bit wacky races.
Cartoon.
A bit wacky races, but you get the point. You know, that's how they really draw in their victims. You know, they charm them. They make them laugh. They, you know, get themselves, you know, they allow the victims to let their guards down, like these people do around the campfire. And I thought that was a really, really interesting way to go. And linking it slightly back to Freddy Krueger, because I did say that I felt like there was a small link. Not necessarily so much about the methods of the characters, because they're very different. There's really no similarities there as well. But more in terms of our perception as a viewer, I feel like one of the reasons why Freddy is such a popular villain, because he's there, he's in that top three. The three most, I think, most popular villains. You know, some people may have a slightly different top three, but Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger, Jason, they're always up and about there for everyone. You know, some people might decide that Ghostface is up there, some people might think Chucky's up there instead, but for the large part, it's those three. And the reason why I think Freddy specifically is up there, because he as well, as a villain, is very charismatic. You know, he has all these funny one-liners, he tells jokes, he cracks, you know, he really does spend a lot of his time, you know, making fun of his victims. And it's in a very different way, of course, but even when Mick turns in this movie, and Mick turns, like, it is frightening. You know, when he's got, I think it's when he's got Christy tied up in his shed, you know, and he's still, the jokes obviously at this point are very, very different, and they're very, very terrifying and horrendous, but he's still trying to be that jovial person. But then he turns, you know, just at the click of a finger, and he screams in her face, and that's terrifying for me.
Yeah, it goes to show just how quickly the charm can be switched off, and then you have the sinister intent and the real person behind the mask that is worn. You know, and I don't know. Yeah, I guess you could make an argument. Maybe, you know, maybe he was schizophrenic, or maybe he had DID, and, you know, he had some sort of mental disorder where he could switch in between these personalities. And I wouldn't go so far. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I will say this, like when he's in the barn and, you know, Christy's tied up there, you know, he gets the gun out and he even holds it, points it at her. She's screaming at the top of her lungs. You know, she's a lot worse for wear than Lizzie was after Lizzie kind of peers in. But, you know, he even holds it up to her and goes bang. You know, it frightens her. And so, you know, he has enough wit and comprehension of wit. He's not a stupid man.
No, absolutely not. And again, there's other instances of that. Just quickly before we move on from that sort of rifle scene where he shouts bang, were you like me and did you just want a small flag with the word bang to just roll out of the end of the rifle?
Someone has watched way too much Looney Tunes, but also yes.
Honestly, I wouldn't even have been mad. But
it would have worked though. I mean, with the way that he behaves, that this is the kind of thing that he would do.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, you're talking about there about, you know, he's not a stupid man. He's actually a very, very smart man. You know, and he number one, you know, he's very good with weapons and cars. You know, he's obviously very sort of mechanically minded. You know, he's also, like we've already said, he's very, very charming. He has very good wit. And I don't think you can be I think you have to be an intelligent person to have good wit. You know, I think those two really do go hand in hand with each other. And, you know, but he's also very, very knowledgeable about sort of the anatomy. You know, we're talking about, you know, the head on the stick scene. Which is a pretty gruesome scene, you know, for those who don't know what we're talking about. But he pretty much tells the story where, you know, yeah, the reason prisoners of war, what they would do to prisoners of war in I think it was Vietnam he was talking about, was that they would sever their spinal cords so that they couldn't run away, but they could still get information out of them. And that because their bodies were effectively dead or you know, wouldn't move, they were basically just a head on the stick, which is obviously very gruesome. And of course, by this point, he's already, you know, chopped off like three of her fingers. You know, he's already stabbed her through the chair in the car. You know, she's been through the mill by this point.
Yeah. I'm talking about Lizzie. As she's already at that point tried to get Christy out. They had already made a run for it, you know, and even dumped the truck to try to escape him. And then she goes back, Lizzie goes back to try to find Ben. And
the funny thing is, actually, sorry to interrupt you there. And it's one of the criticisms I actually have about specifically the sort of first half an hour of this movie. She doesn't actually go back to find Ben. She goes back to get another car.
Wait, really?
Yeah. So, because when they escape in the truck the first time, when Liz and Christy escape in the truck, and obviously they push it over the side of the crater, they've got nowhere left to go, because you can't walk through the Australian outback. You know, it's so vast. You don't know what direction you're going in. So, you know, the thought of walking through it, and it's not a case of, you know, there can be days and weeks where no one will go past. And I'm going to link this back in to an earlier scene and something that you had said a little bit earlier as well. But so, you know, when they've pushed that truck over the side, they have no choice really but to go back. So they're not really going back to find Ben. They both leave Ben behind the first time.
This is true. And, you know, that makes a whole lot more sense. I'm like, are we falling into the horror movie trope of, like, you know, going right back to the killer's den just after you escaped because of some sort of arbitrary reason? No, that makes a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, it did make a lot of logical sense. But one of the criticisms that I had in this, because we'll jump back. I wanted to quickly jump back towards the start of the movie. We do get a lot. There's, I think it's like, is it about 40 minutes worth of, you know, these people are partying. They're traveling clearly across Australia. You know, they're going to Wolf Creek. It's actually a very long time before Mick even shows up in this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we spend a very long time, and, you know, there's, whilst this is going on, there's this sort of budding romance going on between Liz and Ben, and, you know, we see them kissing at the crater and things like that. But if Liz doesn't go back for Ben, which she technically doesn't, and then, you know, she doesn't really show that much interest in finding him when she gets there. I think she asks a couple of times, oh, have you seen Ben? But it's almost like it's a bit of an afterthought. And, you know, it kind of makes me wonder, why did we have that sort of storyline? Or why did we have a lot of our time taken up in those early sort of 40 minutes of the movie talking about this sort of budding romance between these two? There was never really a payoff to that.
I didn't really feel like there was much to say. Like, I mean, Ben is part of the beginning of the movie. And I think the only real payoff that we get is at the gas station. And I'll get to that in a minute. Mm. But the beginning of it, you know, Ben's kind of this laddish dude. And, you know, either Christy and Lizzie, they're from England. Whereas Ben is Australian. So it's almost like he's kind of like showing them around, taking them around for a good time, et cetera. And I mean, we could kind of get that in just 10 minutes worth of movie.
Yeah.
Where there's really something that's relevant is the gas station scene. You know, they pull off, I think it's, what was it, Emu Creek? There was a sign that was like, yeah, no fuel for however many hundreds of miles. So they decide to tank up. They're there. They're getting their fuel. And so it was, I think it was Lizzie that was in the shop there. And, you know, there's these kind of like rough and tumble sort of, you know, Australian redneck, if that's a thing, kind of guys. And they start making snide remarks and inappropriate comments. And then Ben walks in, and when, you know, they have their interchange, and, you know, they barely miss an altercation. Mm-hmm. You know, he starts powering up his camera. They're out of the shop, and the video camera that he has there, that's where it becomes relevant. Yes. Because later on, when Lizzie's running around trying to find, I think she was trying to find keys,
yeah,
finds not Ben's
Ben.
Stuff.
Keys, not Ben.
Yo, and so finds Ben's stuff, finds his camera, looks at it, and there's Mick's truck that, yes, they had dumped over. So Mick was there at that station, mm-hmm, when they were there. And I don't know necessarily if there was any real relation to the rough and tumble sorts of folks that were in the shop, but it almost seems like those would be his sort of kin.
Yes, absolutely. And it does very much give off that, you know, he potentially could be friends with these people as well. But what I also found that scene was really good in demonstrating was almost, again, the intelligence of Mick. Because the people in the shop, they don't come across as people of high intelligence. That's probably quite a nice way of putting it. But Mick's obviously, you know, depends who's offering. but yeah, so, you know, Mick's obviously been tracking them for some time. You know, he picks his moment for when he decides to sort of reveal himself to them as well. So it goes, mm-hmm, much, much deeper than we ever possibly think. Because in the beginning, you know, I don't know if you're the same, but you just sort of assume that, you know, he just sort of trolls the wilderness, and if he comes across a tourist or if he comes across people in trouble, then he's going to take advantage of that situation. But in actual fact, he seeks them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he stalked them. He knew that they were there and somehow had enough information about who they were, whether, I mean, I didn't see him inside the shop. I didn't see him outside at the gas station either, even though he was there, obviously, in some capacity. So does he just hang out at Emu Creek knowing that, like, okay, if you're going to journey, you're obviously going to go it alone for a prolonged period of time? I can only assume, but he obviously stalked them in some capacity to follow them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Quickly, before we move on, were you like me? Did you feel bad for Graham?
I'm sorry, did I feel bad for who?
Graham, the shop, the gas station sort of attendant. He just looked like he was so embarrassed by the guys that we were talking about. He's, you know, and the look of disappointment on his face. He's like, damn it, there's another three paying customers gone.
I got the impression that he realized he had a face for radio and he was probably picked on for it. And so, like, when he was even on the video there for a moment, like, he kind of came up right behind Ben as Ben was tanking up.
Yeah.
And, you know, startled Ben. Ben looked at him like, you know, he was the weirdest thing. Like, he was an alien, right? And I think he was probably aware of that in some capacity. He's just like, oh, come on, not this again.
It's clearly happened on many occasions before. Oh, that's all. That's all we can say, I guess. But and speaking about that videotape that we're talking about as well, where, you know, we see Mick's truck in the background, we get a little clip before we actually see that as well of Mick with other victims. You know, and he's saying, like, the same things to the victims that he said to this group. You know, he's saying rainwater straight from the top and those sorts of things. But one of the things I thought this was really effective in doing is actually just showing, for a lack of a better term, how much of a bastard that Mick actually is, because you know there's kids in that group, and in that video he's being very, very charming again. You know, he's clearly very good with the kids when he's being charming and things like that, but that obviously just goes to show, you know, he wipes out families. You know, he's non-discriminatory. He will kill anyone he comes across.
Yeah, and you know what's even worse is there is that kind of I don't want to say sexual tension. It wasn't really sexual tension, but that sort of douchebag moment where he starts, you know, rubbing his groin in front of Christy while she's tied up. And she's obviously bleeding and very distressed. And he's getting his rocks off. If there's kids involved, that's a next level sort of scummy thing to do. Like, that's just reprehensible.
Yes, absolutely. And I think... You know, if you're not really paying attention to this movie, you know, if you're just sort of watching casually, it might be something that you don't really pick up on. But obviously, you know, if you're really sort of watching this movie, that's definitely things you'll pick up on. Because we also see a number of other just, you know, mutilated corpses in this movie as well. I think this I don't think some people realize how sort of gruesome and grim this movie actually is. It's pretty dark.
It's got an underground well of corpses in different varying degrees of decay. So if when, you know, the scene happens that Lizzie is coming back and she's looking for a car, she finds herself down in this, like, well, and there's a mound of corpses, you know, some of them rotting, some of them are just skeletal remains. He's been doing this for a long time. He is a cold, calculated, ruthless killer. He's a shiny, polished turd.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Completely agree. Okay, so we've obviously just spent a very long time discussing Mick, but there was quite a lot to get through. Is there anything else you want to speak about Mick before I move on to another subject?
Nothing that I can think of off top of my head. I'm sure that there's something will come to me as I tie it into other things and how they relate. But if you want to move on to the next bit, I could talk about this for hours.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Obviously, anything else pops into our heads, then we'll just go with it. One of the things that I want to sort of move on from is that it was something that I actually found very, very clever about this movie. So obviously in horror films, and specifically slasher films as well, we're very, very used to the trope of the final girl. You know, that's a very, very famous thing. You know, we've even had a movie called The Final Girls and TV shows and things like that. And, you know, when you think of final girls, you know, there's four or five names that will automatically pop into your head. You know, there's Laurie Strode, there's, you know, Sidney Prescott, there's, Ellen Ripley and others as well, you know, Heather Langenkamp and things like that. But this movie turned that on its head and we actually get a final guy.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and for the longest time in this movie as well, we didn't think we were going to get that because the story mainly follows Liz. So when Liz actually dies, and she dies pretty close to the end of the movie as well, actually. You know, it's not, I think by the time she dies, there's maybe, what, 10 to 12 minutes left of the movie. So there's obviously a chunk that you know that there's sort of more coming. But, and in actual fact as well, she dies first.
She does. The protagonist actually dies first. And Ben, if for the majority of it, after the introduction and those 30 minutes of him being a lad, he's gone. He's not even present. Like he's mentioned, what, twice?
He's mentioned twice. I think we get a very, very brief scene that just tells us he's alive.
Yep.
And then that's it. So you've got a solid, what, 50 minutes of movie where one of those sort of three main characters, these three main protagonists, and he's just gone. You know, just gone, nowhere to be heard of. You initially just think, oh, well, maybe he's just dead. You know, maybe Mick just killed him straight away. Maybe he's only really interested in the women, like we were going back to in terms of, you know, the scene where he grabs his crotch and things like that. But obviously we then get told that he's still alive. But I just find that really, really interesting because we've watched, you know, we watch so many films that have this final girl trope. And in here, it looks very much like you're getting the same thing. But with, you know, a quarter of an hour left of the movie, our final girl, she's not the final girl, there's two other characters who are alive, but for all intents and purposes, our final girl dies. And then at that point, you're like, right, well, all bets are off now.
Exactly. And it was interesting when you finally get to see, like, things from, you know, Christie's perspective.
Yes.
Now, I was expecting, okay, maybe it's kind of like an underdog sort of thing, and she's going to make a getaway. She actually does get a car. Mm-hmm. She is able to get away. Granted, it was because some passerby who took pity on her got shot through the noggin, but, you know, I know, I liked him, and he got shot right through the eyeball. Did you find it comedic, though, that when she did, you know, she comes across this guy, he pulls over and he's trying to get some like medical equipment or something from the back, right? He pulls out his canteen and puts it atop the hood. He bends into his hatch, pulls his, like, the camera pans back up and he stands upward again, looks at his canteen. And it's just dripping fluid, like there's a bullet through it. And he's like, what the heck? And then he wasn't long for this world after that. But
it almost links back to what we were saying earlier. It's kind of Looney Tunes, you know, it's kind of cartoonish. It's very sort of Wile E. Coyote sort of joke there, because and it's very funny. It's very effective here, you know, because, and again, that's one of the things, you know, even when he's being evil, just plain old evil, he's still cracking jokes, he's still being very charismatic, and I felt that thing that really sort of played into that a little bit. I thought it was very, very funny. I did feel sorry for the car driver as well. I kind of also found it just amusing when she comes on and she's just like, Jesus Christ. You know, like, holy fuck, what's going on here? And then he's not long for this world, like you say. And then obviously, you know, Christie, she gets away, and there's this sort of car chase as well where you think she's gotten the better of him too. You know, he pulls up alongside her and he's making, you know, all these inappropriate gestures. He's cracking jokes. Like, I like that face. It's like the meme, you know, of two people passing each other in the cars. Have you seen that meme? And it's things like, oh, when you've told your friend that, you know, you're too tired to go to a party, but then you bump into them at the party and it's two people and they're sort of looking at each other accusatorily. It's very, very like that. And he's like, oh, hey, there's you. And I thought that was very amusing. I described that terribly.
Well, I know exactly what you're referring to, because there's a pervasive sense of irony. And I think that the irony with Ben, I'll get to that a little bit later, but there's an ironic moment there too. But to circle back to Christy, for instance, she even goes so far as to actually run his gas guzzler off the road. Like, this thing sounds like it's got like a V6 in there. I mean, it's chugging away. He's got to have dropped something, some sort of engine in there, that it's got muscle behind it. And this little like four banger station wagon jalopy that this old man was driving, and she manages to run him off the road. And I would imagine that everybody watching is sitting there going like, yeah, Christy, all right. So we're getting some traction here. Maybe there's going to be a good ending after all. Well, no, he's got his rifle. He's a sharpshooter. Pops that tire. She goes spinning off. I mean, the thing is wrecked. It rolls right over. She goes stumbling out, and all he does is have to stalk up to her. He puts two in her back.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just done.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as well, it also goes back, I think, a little bit to the sort of cruelty of Mick as well, and just sort of the plain brutality of him. Because when he shoots out the tire, he could have easily just killed her. He could have shot her instead mm-hmm. of shooting the tire. That wouldn't have been any more difficult for him to do than shooting out the tire. But he chooses to shoot the tire. He chooses to make her crash. And then he chooses just to completely put her out of her misery. And then burns the body, you know? So it goes back to those sort of two very different sides of the same coin. Here we are. You know, we desperately tried to talk about other things in this movie, but it just keeps coming back to Mick. But, you know, it goes back to that whole sort of two sides thing. You've got that, you know, wise-cracking, joke-making guy. And then at the flip of a coin, he just turns. He just turns, and he's this complete brutal motherfucker.
Well, it kind of goes like teasing. Like, you have the very fine line between banter and bullying. You know, obviously, you know, it's the two sides of the same coin. The only difference is consent. And so you have somebody who is. He's very charismatic, and he's able to tap into that wit and that irony. He knows what he's doing. And he is satisfying his humor, his sick sense of humor, by torturing these people. The fear that washes over their face, there must be some sort of like thrill that he gets out of watching terror and defeat wash over their countenance.
Absolutely, absolutely. There was a point that you'd brought up earlier that I wanted to make a point about, but I forgot. So it's about when obviously our three sort of main protagonists, they're having some car trouble, let's just say. Before actually I get onto it, we've all had a car like theirs, right? It's just a complete bucket of rust. For me, I had a Renault Clio that, you know, the horn on it didn't work. I didn't realize at the time because I bought it secondhand. The horn didn't work, so I went to sort of honk my horn at someone and nothing happened, and I felt very ashamed. The hazard lights wouldn't like turn off, but so I had to like screw the button down so that the hazard lights wouldn't flash. My radio was held in by, you know, sellotape. I thought that the car was running okay. But then one day I realized that the previous owner had just put black tape on the dash to hide the check engine light.
Oh, really?
So one day I was like cleaning my car and I'd switched the engine on and I looked. And obviously because I was looking at it from the side, I could see that the check engine light was on. And I was like, I didn't know that light was there. And then I just noticed that there was like duct tape over it.
Unbelievable. Insane. No.
So I had that car, just not the same kind. I don't know, like, sure, like, I don't know, do you drive? You drive, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm driving something a lot nicer now. It's a, it's a 2018 Type R, so you can go take a look at Civic Type R pictures and you'll find exactly what that is. Yeah. But my first car, I bought from an old lady. I'm not going to say that it was my grandmother, but it was my grandmother. So, it wasn't really driven, but it was this nice little, like pretty good condition 2000 Pontiac Sunfire. And okay. Pontiac, it was a GM vehicle, and Pontiac Sunfire was kind of like the cousin of the Chevrolet Cavalier. They interchanged a lot of parts. In fact, it was this pretty much the same thing with just a different body on it. Mm. So it had been like it was over 10 years old, I think, by the time that I got it. And when I, you know, started driving it, like, I was like, oh, okay, you know, it's in good condition. It's work. I can drive this for a little while. First week, one of the headlights go. And I'm like, well, that's weird. So I replaced the headlight. It didn't change anything. No, the electrical went on it. I was like, oh, come on. So I had to get that replaced. On the way there, on the way to the shop to get that replaced, a car, two cars ahead of me, two car lengths ahead of me, it just slams into a deer.
Oh, no.
On the way to the shop. And I'm just like, this is spelling disaster seven ways to Sunday. I spent, just to keep the thing on the road for the 1 year that I had it, I spent as much as I paid to buy the thing, including the day that I moved out of my parents' house and into my own apartment. First time moving out, and the muffler falls off. I mean, it literally just falls off in the middle of moving. I'm like, are you kidding me?
So, I mean, the car that I was talking about, it really wasn't very expensive at all. It cost me a few hundred pounds, that was it. But the day it finally broke down, there was a problem with the oil sump in it, and it would, you know, I eventually was having to fill it up almost every day with fresh oil.
Oh.
Which is obviously not ideal, but one day my engine just completely seized because obviously it was running dry, despite the fact that I filled it up with oil about 8 hours previously. So the guy came to sort of tow me back into town, because at this time I lived slightly outside the city, and so he got me to the garage. And, you know, I was on my way to work at the time. It was 4 a.m. It was December. So I was standing on the side of the road with only my lighter for warmth.
Oh.
And, you know, I could see my colleagues driving past me on the bus, just looking all warm and cozy. So I went to work, I left the car at the garage, and I came back to them, and they were like, look, your car's just not worth fixing. For what your car's like and how much it would cost you, it's really not worth the cost. So I was like, fine, mm-hmm. Okay. So that was it. My car was going to car heaven. And so I called a guy from a local scrapyard to come and take it away for scrap. And he gave me £30 for my car.
He was considering whether or not you should be paying him to take the vehicle, I'm sure.
Literally. So my car at the end of its days was worth £30, which I think is $45.
I mean, considering like I was wondering week over week, like, what was going to go wrong with my car now? I mean, like for instance, I had to get the lines replaced. When I had to do the muffler, I had to do the entire exhaust manifold, including the O2 sensor. So that was expensive. It came out of work one day, and the driver's side view mirror, right? That was just hanging for no other reason than it was just hanging there. You know, like, so you do. You have to go through that process of evaluating whether or not the cost is worth it. Yeah. Because by that point in time, I was so fed up. I'm like, I'm going into debt so I don't have to pay for this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we've got a little bit off topic. Maybe just a touch off topic.
We could talk more about Mick. I mean,
yeah, sure. I mean that's what we're here for, right? No, the point that I was bringing up, anyway, is yes, that's it. So, you had mentioned earlier about when they were having car trouble, and Mick obviously chose that as his point to introduce himself, to sort of reveal himself to the group.
Yeah,
and you said earlier, you know, these characters didn't have any other choice, really, because I've already obviously mentioned that, you know, staying where they were or, you know, walking to potentially find someone really isn't an option in the sort of wilderness of Australia, just because of how vast that country is and how sparsely populated it is as well. You know, when Mick's telling a story later on about a guy who takes 6 days to drive around his farm, that's probably true in parts of Australia. So I found that as well. Because we've all watched a horror movie where our main characters just make ridiculously stupid choices. You know, they run up the stairs or they go down to the basement and you're just like, what the fuck are you doing? But in this movie, the characters are really forced into their stupid choice, if you will. They had no other option. And I thought that was really smart in doing as well, because it almost made them more sympathetic to us, I felt, as a viewer. I don't know if you felt like that as well.
We've all been to that scenario where our shitty car finally bites the dust and we have to deal with the inconvenience of figuring out, well, one, where am I going to get my transportation from? And two, how do I get this either A to the shop or B to the scrapyard? I mean, he only paid like $1,500 for it. And I don't know how that translates like Australian dollars to US dollars, for instance. But I mean, that's not a lot of money. It looked like he had like a check done before he finally decided to take it on its maiden voyage. But since we know that Mick was there at the station, and then they spent the better part of the day with the car parked there, and Mick knows his way around cars, and we already know he's been stalking them.
Yeah.
Was Mick the reason that their car broke down?
I assumed that Mick, whilst obviously knew they were on the trail in Wolf Creek, he'd either followed them there or something or the other, and I just assumed that you know, he had done something to their car whilst they were away on the hike. That's just the assumption I made. We're never explicitly told that. The other thing, the one thing that did sort of bother me is the thing with the watches, where we're never explicitly told what, you know, both Ben and Christie's watches stop working at the exact same time. And that's never really explained in the movie as well. But I guess that's really a minor thing. And just because I really wanted to know, $1,500 Australian works out at $1,186 United States.
I mean, that's something that you buy your 16-year-old for them to learn how to drive stick on. You know what I mean? So, and it was actually interesting. My wife Lori mentioned this. You know, she's like, well, why can't they pop the clutch? And if you pay attention to the gearbox, it's an automatic transmission. So that I thought was a bit puzzling. And obviously then they can't pop the clutch either. They have no real recourse here to try to get the car jumped without somebody coming in with the alligator cables and connecting it and jumping their vehicle. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Mick looking at it and seeming knowledgeable on the topic, he plays the con man instead. I bet you anything, there probably wasn't anything really that difficult or that involved to repair the vehicle.
Yeah, and it probably was just a simple case of he'd, you know, unplugged something. That sounds really bizarre.
A spark plug. Yeah,
or something.
He was
that.
Talking about the spark plugs. Yeah.
Yeah, and it probably was something that was really just as simple as that. And you know, but obviously none of these three characters knew anything about cars or knew much about cars. I have to admit that I'd be in the same camp as them. I don't know a huge amount about cars. I like the way cars look. And that's how I sort of judge my cars. But yeah, so like I wouldn't have been there as well. So I just sort of thought that was something again that was really quite subtle, that once you're sort of looking at it, you think, oh, actually that's really smart of Mick. But it also makes, you know, our character is very sympathetic at the same time. So I thought that was a really, really clever way of showing good qualities that you want in your villain and in your protagonist as well, in just this one very simple set play.
Right. We find very readily. I don't think that the characters, the protagonists, are quite as fleshed out, obviously, as Mick is, because Mick is primarily the draw here. But it's nice that he's not like a one or two dimensional killer. There's a lot of aspects to him that I think are very, very brilliantly fleshed out in the way that the situations play out with the characters. The characters themselves, I mean, they're pretty relatable. Like, you know, they're walking up Wolf Creek and it starts to rain. And, you know, one of the girls comments is like, oh, I don't have a jumper. You know, like just little subtleties like that just kind of bring them to life. I very, very much felt connections with pretty much every character that you came across, apart from those old fogies at the shop.
Yeah,
that
they,
fuck
they,
those guys.
They can go fuck themselves.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Right out of my mouth. But yeah, one of the interesting things actually about, you know, you sort of go to, you're talking about that sort of relatability to our main characters here is they basically filmed every single scene in this movie twice, which is quite an amazing thing, and I'll explain why when we get to the trivia. But they basically filmed every scene twice. They filmed one scene that was completely to the script, pretty much to the letter, and then they would film it again, but allowing the directors to improvise and to improvise and play around with the scene. And a lot of the footage that actually came from those scenes ended up in the movie. So that's potentially why you maybe found them to be a little bit more relatable, and things like the scene where, you know, she's like, oh, I forgot my jumper, or the scene where he's sort of pretending that his torch is a lightsaber. You know, that was all improvised stuff.
That makes sense, because when you're just reading from a script, there's a kind of that mechanical element that leaves it somewhere in the uncanny valley. And there's nothing worse than like you're watching a movie and you're like, wow, the acting is just kind of like regurgitated. Yes. And you can sense that. And with this, I just felt like each of the characters, they had personality, they had charm. I mean, they're, you know, some are less likable than others, but at the very least, believable.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I don't think I came away, like, obviously, you know, I may have I have a slight issue maybe with the pacing of the first sort of third of this movie, but mm-hmm. I never at any point felt that, you know, oh, I disliked any of our sort of main protagonists or anything like that. So I felt like they did a really good job with that. One of the last things that I have on my list, anyway, of things that I want to talk about, and it's going back to Mick again. I'm sorry, but he's what you come here for, you know.
Mick is the new COVID now. I mean, we just keep circling back to it. Hold on, I need some rainwater from the top here.
That's perfectly fine. He keeps people locked up for 3 weeks and then kills them, just like COVID.
What? Oh, Ian!
Sorry, too dark, too soon.
It's a little too real, man. Okay, all right. My childhood is already crumpled up in the corner, shriveling away.
I'm sorry. but anyways, the point that I want to make. So, we've talked about how, you know, our main characters maybe aren't as fleshed out as they possibly could be. But Mick has some very, very, very well fleshed out characteristics to him and aspects of his character. But in actual fact, aside from the fact that he used to be a head sniper on a farm, we really know nothing about Mick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's very little backstory. We don't really know how he started, how he decided that he was going to start killing people. We don't get any of that. And I think that works very, very well for this movie. I don't think we need any of that. But I just found it really quite amusing that, you know, we spend a good sort of 40 minutes of the first part of this movie just focusing on these three characters. There's no horror aspects to the first 40 minutes of this movie. You know, they're partying. You know, okay, they have the horrendous interaction with the guys at the station, but they're partying, they're traveling, they're going to this meteorite site, and they're just having a bit of a good time. But they're not particularly well fleshed out. You know, as far as we're concerned, all we know is that Ben has a girlfriend back in Sydney, but is clearly smitten with Liz. So, bad boy Ben. And that Liz fancies Ben back. Christy is really not that fleshed out at all as a character. You know, we don't really learn much about her, if anything at all. And then here's Mick, who, number one, you're supposed to sort of despise and want to see people, you know, get their comeuppance on him, but he's potentially the best fleshed out character here, yet we don't really learn anything about him.
And isn't that just a positive, solid example of when you see a con man, you don't know anything about them, but somehow they're inherently likable. And at the end of the day, they use their charm and you get swindled because you bought into what they had to say. And there was just something about them that you naturally gravitate toward.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. No, I completely agree. And I feel like that's definitely the sort of thing that they're trying to portray here. And I think they do it pretty expertly, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's everything that I've really got on my list that I want to cover. You know, I've talked about our three main characters, you know, like, I've talked about a couple of the issues that I've had, but really the meat and potatoes of this movie is all about Mick. But is there anything else that you noticed, you highlighted, or anything that you want to talk about with regards to this movie?
Well, what I thought was actually pretty interesting, and this is, it's just to demonstrate the irony that is throughout the movie. You see that when Ben escapes, I mean, he's walking through the wilderness for at least a day after having been literally pinned to a wall. He gets himself free. He manages to escape. And at that point, he's just meandering. He's just wandering. And so he's picked up after finally collapsing on the roadside. He's picked up by, guess what? Tourists.
Yes.
So there's some irony in that, I feel. But I also wonder if, you know, Mick did leave Ben to just go. Because the even more brutal irony is, initially, Ben was the one who was suspect for both Lizzie and Christy missing.
Yes. It was almost as if he realized that if Ben escaped and got back, that it would actually take the heat off him.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, again, it goes back to this whole thing that there's huge parts of, you know, Australia that are there's really just nothing there. It's just wilderness. And it says in the end blurb, you know, because this is loosely, very loosely based on some true stories, that, you know, they really couldn't locate where this place was, because earlier in the movie as well, when Mick is sort of towing them back to the camp, you know, they say, oh, that feels like we've been driving for hours. So even if they were to say, right, we'll take you back to Wolf Creek, you know, it could be in any direction and for any potential length of time that this camp is in. So it would be very, very difficult to locate. And I would imagine for a lot of the time as well, you're talking dirt tracks, you're not talking, you know, tarmac roads. There's no, they're not mapped out. So it would be very, very difficult to find. And again, it goes back, like you say, it's you've got the irony there in terms of, you know, he's saved by other tourists as well. But again, it goes back and speaks to the intelligence of Mick.
Yep. And you, when he talks about, like, oh, you know, you want to go back into town, because Ben mentions it, you know, the girls want to go back into town. Hey, could you give us a trip back into town? He's like, well, town's north. I'm going south. And then he has that chuckle, that raspy chuckle. It's you hear even more of it in Wolf Creek 2,
yeah,
which is absolutely brilliant. And I'm not going to get too much into that, but you can see how he really fleshed out his character in two as well.
Yeah.
And the chuckle that he gives, and it's almost, it's again, just serves to be disarming. Mm-hmm. And you get to see more of that wit and charisma in the second movie. But point being, he says, okay, so, you know, north is town, and he says that he's going south to camp. And I mean, God only knows if that's where he ends up taking them or not. But
yeah.
I mean, that's as much as we get as far as like cardinal directions or relative distance between place to place.
Yeah, and I think it, well, it serves, you know, it almost serves to disorientate us as a viewer as well, because specifically, obviously, you know, we're not Australian. I've never been to Australia. I don't know if you've been to Australia or not, but I would imagine, you know, most people who are not from Australia probably haven't been. You know, so you generally don't really have any sort of frame of reference anyway for where these people are. And then suddenly, right, you don't know if you're going north, you don't know if you're going south. You know, he says, you know, camp south. Camp could be any blooming point on the compass, you know. So,
true.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And can I just say about the laugh, Mick's laugh, because it's almost iconic, is Mick's laugh.
It is.
And we've really not touched on it. And I find it's very funny as well. Because you're talking about it there in that sense, you know, when they're sort of talking to each other, and it's something that's very good at sort of disarming the protagonists, you know, it lets that they set their guard down almost. And specifically, I'm talking about the scene where now Lizzie's trying to escape. She's trying to find a new car to escape, and Mick's sitting in the back seat. And you know, he just lets out that laugh. And the difference in tone, it's the exact same laugh as he was doing, you know, around the campfire when they're sort of laughing and cracking jokes. It's the exact same laugh, but the tonal shift between then and him sitting in the back of the seat is massive.
It's extraordinary. And to even in that moment, he still carries that sense of humor.
Yes.
And it's obvious too, from when she starts to, you know, realize that she's been caught and coming to grips with her demise, for instance, you know, he's already plunged the giant knife right through the seat and through her back and abdomen. And then she's stumbled out of the car. She procures a pocket knife, like a Swiss Army knife looking thing. And he's got this giant thing that looks like a bayonet or a machete of some sort. And he harkens back to a comment that Ben made at the campfire earlier, where he said, you know, like he's making that joke where he's mocking the accent, and he's like, oh man, you must be able to look at people and be like, no, like that's a knife. I got a knife right here. You know, like,
that's when
like Mick stares him down, probably because he and I, by proxy, just did a really, really bad Australian accent, but But she holds that out to him, and then what does she do? She lops off his fingers after saying the same thing, like, nah, this is a knife, you know?
yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things as well that almost, again, it almost harkens me back as well to the negative I had about not really having the payoff between Ben and Liz, because we get a payoff for so many things in this movie. Things like that comment around the campfire where Yunus says, that's not a knife. And I must just say, as a Scotsman, I sympathise with every Australian having to listen to people butcher your accent. It's fine. I know how you feel. I sympathise with you. You know, you can message me and talk about it. It's fine.
There's therapy, I promise.
But yeah, you know, it's a callback. It's linking things before, and that's always it's so smart to do. And it's just another reason why I think this movie is so clever for the most part. Like I say, I have had a couple of little critiques of it, but nothing that's really ruined my enjoyment of this movie.
There is one last thing I want to touch on, which is part of the reason, and I think an explanation about why I think Ben gets away, but also explains why I think Ben was captured in the first place.
Okay.
So we already have established Mick hates tourists, and that even more so, like, he hates foreigners. When we see him in Wolf Creek 2, it's not just people that are tourists. He just hates foreigners in general. So the reason I feel that he gets, you know, that Ben is even involved at all, is kind of fleshed out in two, where he hates those, like, you know, those prim and proper types, those pretty boyish looking fellows. Like, no, he likes man's men.
Yes,
and that's what he, you know, Mick thinks that men should be. And he hates these, you know, dainty little, I guess, snowflakes. I don't know what he would really consider them, but you know what I mean? Then you see that in two. And I think that applies to Ben, but I think also Ben was allowed to escape, not just because of the scapegoat mentality that Mick feels he could benefit from, but also because Ben's Australian.
Yeah, you know what? Like, I hadn't really sort of put those two things together, but now that you obviously lay it out, and like you say, it does become much more evident when you watch Wolf Creek 2 about you know, Mick's sort of general hatred for foreigners. I never really actually put those two together, but it's almost like he doesn't want to kill one of his own.
Even if he doesn't like, you know, this kind of dainty masculine men, at least they're from the homeland, right? You know?
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point that you bring up, and it's definitely one that I hadn't considered before. So yeah, that's very interesting.
I thought that was at least something that kind of had a little bit more meaning anyway, you know, given the context of both two and the fact that Ben was Australian, because I thought it was interesting. I'm like, okay, well, you've got these two girls that happen to be, you know, from England. Mm-hmm. They're obviously on holiday. One of them comments that they've only got like 1 or 2 days left, and that's when they want, you know, they're going to Wolf Creek and they're going on this road trip to kind of like have their last hurrah.
Yeah.
But why Ben was involved at all in the first place, or how they really knew Ben at all, I mean, that wasn't really touched on. The payoff between the romance, like you mentioned, wasn't touched on. And then I felt like, you know, Christy was, she wasn't really, really particularly eye candy necessarily, but she was just like that kind of like fly on the wall sort of pretty face that was there for a lot of it too.
There wasn't a huge amount of purpose to her character really, other than, you know, to give us a couple of gruesome scenes really to flesh Mick out more than anything else, which they did to good effect. But Christy was definitely the least fleshed out of the three.
Agreed.
Even though that the other two weren't particularly fleshed out either, I felt like she was definitely the most sort of disposable of the three characters.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. And she was kind of a moody bitch for like the first half of it too.
She starts off okay, but then as soon as like the car breaks down, she's like, Ben's just like, fuck you, Ben. Like, I don't want to talk to you. You're a dick. You bought us a broken car. And then none of it's Ben's fault.
No, none of it at all. It was probably Mick intentionally.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Awesome. Right. Anything else that you want to touch upon?
No, I think that that kind of settles all of the highlights and story beats that I really wanted to reflect on during the podcast today.
Awesome. Okay, let's move on to the next segment then. We'll talk about some trivia. So, as always, we will start off with the finances of this movie. And this is where I think this movie really changes from, you know, being a great movie to being a very, very impressive movie. This movie had a budget of $1 million. Like, made for no money. This movie was made for almost literally pennies, if it wasn't in the millions. You know, that is a tiny budget for a movie post-millennium, a post-millennium horror movie as well. And for me, that's majorly impressive. Box office worldwide, it made $30.8 million. So, big success as well. You know, 30 times its budget, this movie was really, really popular.
Yeah, it was extraordinarily successful. And when you think of like movies like you could take Saw, for instance, the first Saw, or like the first Paranormal Activity, yes, or Blair Witch, you know, those other sort of like indie horrors where they were very low budget as well. Mm-hmm. And they've done something extraordinary with it and then became a very like critically acclaimed success. I would rank Wolf Creek right along with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I would as a viewer anyway. The critics, however, which we'll get onto in the rating, perhaps not so much. This was the highest grossing R-rated movie in Australian cinema history. So, yeah, like you're saying, you know, made for peanuts. And I think probably Paranormal Activity is the best example of that. You know, $15,000 budget made hundreds of millions of dollars. And eight other movies. I think we've got another movie coming soon in the next couple of years as well.
I hope so. Oh, I love that series.
I'd like to, up to a point, I felt if they dropped off a little bit for me in the last few, but I'm excited to see what they do with the new one. I'm definitely looking forward to doing that. But I think three is my favorite from the PA franchise, but that's a conversation for a different episode.
I was going to say, are we going to start like, because Laurie and I, we do every year. I have the box set of both Saw and Paranormal Activity franchises. Okay. So we do this each year and we go through front to back, you know, and we kind of binge it over the course of maybe 2-3 weeks, et cetera. And yes, then we'll move on and then do the Paranormal Activity or the Saw one, whichever one we hadn't done. And so, you know, is our next episode going to be the start of the Paranormal Activity episodes? Because, I mean, I'm so down with that.
We'll need to get you back for 8 more episodes just so that we can cover the entire franchise.
We can do that in a couple of days. We got this.
Yeah, that's fine. We can just bang out the episodes. We'll get a couple of days off and we'll just shoot through them.
we'll bang it out over a couple of six packs. It'll be
absolutely
fine.
Absolutely. Where am I? I've completely lost my place. That's so good of you.
Sorry.
No, not at all. I was talking about how impressive it was that they were filming pretty much every scene twice. Obviously, they were filming them more than twice, but in terms of two different versions of every single scene. And what made that impressive is that they made this movie in 25 days. Which is, as you probably know as well from being a fan of cinema, is no time at all.
No, that's less than a month. So the amount of recording that they must have done must have been like I can't imagine, because if they're not taking that many takes and they're getting two different captures, you know, of the same scene in quick succession of one another, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the other things as well that's actually quite unusual about filming movies, not just horror movies in general, is that they filmed this movie chronologically as well, which doesn't really tend to happen. So they filmed the movie as we see it on screen as well, which is something that that doesn't tend to happen too much in cinema. And going again to the fact that we're on such a tight deadline, so the rain that takes place while they visit Wolf Creek, Wolf Creek is a real place. It's spelt different, it's got an E on the end of it, but Wolf Creek in Australia is a real place. But they didn't have the time to stop filming when it rained. It hadn't rained in Wolf Creek for 10 years. And then they started filming there and it began to rain. And so the director decided, you know what, this is so cool because it never rains here. It adds to the atmosphere. It makes everything just seem a little bit more creepy. And they just had to run with it. And the effects that came out from it, I think, were great.
Talk about a spot of serendipity. That's amazing.
I know, I know. And it must have been so surreal as well. Like you say, to be in a place where, you know, 10 years have passed since the last rainfall, and then suddenly you're there filming this movie, and then the rain begins. That's I don't know if that's a good or a bad omen.
But apparently it was a good, like a financial success, right? Absolutely. So I guess it was good.
Absolutely. Definitely. So a couple other bits that I've got just before that we move on to our final segment. The mine that they chose to film, so Mixed Camp, essentially, the mine that they filmed at, was actually the site of a real-life murder previously. A woman was murdered there, but none of the crew were actually aware of this when they chose it. So the movie actually almost got postponed because there was a lot of protests, pretty much, from locals, because they felt that they were being disrespectful of the memory of this woman. But the crew weren't to know, and I think eventually they were allowed to film there. John Jarrett, I mean, we've gone into pretty huge depths now about how well we think John Jarrett did with this movie too. He was the first and only actor to audition for the role of Mick, which again in itself is something that's very unusual when it comes to movies and horror movies. You generally have so many people that you hear are considered for this role or auditioned for this role. No, John Jarrett was the only person who auditioned for this role. He was well known in Australia, apparently, at the time, because he hosted a gardening show.
Of all things,
he was hosting a gardening show. But he was a recognised actor. And one of the things that actually could... I don't know why this surprised me, because this movie was made in 2005. I think it's more the fact that, you know, I have to sort of remind myself that this movie is now 16 years old. Because it doesn't feel like it's that old a movie. John Jarrett wasn't a young man at the time. John Jarrett's almost 70 now in real life.
Like, oh my god.
He's getting up there in years. I mean, 70, obviously, he's still not an old man, but he's not a young man anymore. And I find that kind of, I don't know, I find that, not weird, but just, I thought it was a strange thing. Like, I couldn't picture it in my head, specifically more, I think, because, you know, we've had the sequel, we've had the TV show, and he's coming back to play Mick again in Wolf Creek 3. Spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen Wolf Creek 2, I'm sorry. I'm just going to spoil that one for you. But, you know, so, like, he's not a young man anymore, and I don't know. I found that a strange concept to wrap my head around.
I just see Soldier 76 in the background, and, you know, it's obviously Mick's form just kind of like bulging out in all the wrong places of Soldier 76's suit, and it's yeah. Just him going, I'm not a young man anymore.
Absolutely. Maybe he'll do that in the third one.
Unless he's an Overwatch fan, and like... him being a gardener and then a serial killer in a horror movie, I'm kind of guessing that Overwatch is probably not on his radar.
Maybe, but you know what? You're never too old to start.
This is true. Age is just a number until they're underage. Don't do that. That's worth it. No.
Well, yeah, absolutely. the last piece of trivia that I have. So, if this piece of trivia might not mean a lot to the normal person, now that's poor choice of words there, the average person, but to link it back to one of our episodes that we just released on Warm Bodies, that was our Valentine's Day episode, this was the film debut of Teresa Palmer, who plays one of our main protagonists, one of our two main protagonists in Warm Bodies. She is an extra in this movie as a pool party person, so I just thought that was a cool little link back to a movie, a very, very different type of movie as well. I just thought that was a pretty neat little link.
And speaking of links, I've just been kind of like ruminating on this for a moment. So you know how in the UK, like, the gun violence isn't really a thing because nobody has guns. Not like how it's in America where it's kind of like a cultural thing and people want to fight for it, etc., right?
Yes.
And then you also mentioned how like a number of these takes had to have been authentic because they were allowed to stray and kind of show that human element. They didn't go straight for the script. Mm-hmm. You remember the part where, like, she comes back and she gets you know, into the barn where Christy had been held. Lizzie is making her return, and she gets there. She picks up a revolver, and what does she do? She's looking at the different bullets, and she spends probably 2 minutes worth of screen time trying to figure out which bullet goes into the revolver.
Yes.
Packs the revolver full, you know, six bullets. Every chamber is loaded. Never actually ends up getting to fire the thing. But you also see earlier when she goes to save Christy, like she's shaking like a leaf,
yes,
trying to hold this thing. It's Mick that tells her that the safety's on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like the fact that she wouldn't have been at all in any way, shape or form really exposed to firearms.
No. If she was born and raised in the UK, and she had, there is gun crime here, but it's nothing in comparison to what it is like in the United States.
Right.
Or, you know, the weapons just aren't, those sorts of weapons aren't accessible here to the average person. Knife crime's a big problem here, though, so it's not all hunky-dory. You know, we have problems with knives, but you're absolutely right. It was something that was, that again, you might not pick up on, actually, if you're just, you know, watching the movie quite casually. But you're right.
I'm just curious, like maybe that was all authentic too. Like maybe, you know, as she's in this like mindset of being, you know, frantic and you know, terrified and just trying to survive and protect herself, I wonder, was that genuine or was that scripted?
I would very much believe that it probably was, you know, something that was genuine, you know, because you're absolutely right. She wouldn't, as an English person, have had, I would imagine, anyway, I can't obviously say for certain, but would imagine that she would be someone who had experience handling or shooting any sort of firearms at all. So, no, that's a very interesting, again, very, very interesting point you raise. I always love it when people raise points that I don't notice, so thank you.
Well, it would at least explain why she didn't double tap. So Laurie and I are always mad when they don't go back and double tap.
Right, not only does she not double tap, but she hits him on the back twice. Like, I would be caving this motherfucker's skull in, and I would be hitting, it would be like, you know that scene in Shaun of the Dead where they just have the cricket bat and he's just caving the zombie's head in repeatedly? That's what I would be doing to Mick with the gun if I couldn't fire it. I wouldn't just tap him on the back twice and then be like, right,
you'd
okay.
be singing, I'd be working on the right, like the entire time as you're just like beating him. If Queen isn't playing from a jukebox, I don't know, like give me something, but I would be beating his head in with the butt end of that gun if I couldn't find, but you know, she probably didn't know what sort of ammunition or even how to load the damn thing.
Yeah, because she fumbles around after she shoots it as well to try and, mm-hmm. you know, shoot it again, and then she can't do it and she frees her friend and then just, you know, gives him a wee pat on the back with the butt of the gun. So, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was comedic, that one. It's just like, oh, what are you going to do? Give him a nice pat on the back. Good job dying. Good job dying, Mick.
Oh, just as well. So I know we keep coming back to this. We keep coming back. I'm trying to move us on, but there's so much to talk about.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's the scene, again, going back to the head on the stick scene. Uh-huh. After he's chopped her fingers off, he's telling her, you know, like, oh, I've got a bloody bullet hole in my neck. You don't hear me complaining. And she's sitting her fingers, you know, lying next to her on the ground, crying. And I just found that to be sickly amusing.
The comedic element is there, but it's not like campy comedy. It's very much like a witty irony that pervades throughout the movie, and I think that that's probably one of the strongest aspects of the storytelling. And then you've got coupled with actors that seem genuine and believable with a storyline that isn't too far unbelievable. You know, it's enough that you can suspend your disbelief, mm-hmm. and then with a villain that is so enticing, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And I just want to sort of finish on this point before we move on to the ratings as well. And it's something that we've not actually really talked about in the main bulk of the discussion. One of the aspects that really makes Mick this terrifying character and separates him out from your classic slasher villains is he's just a guy. He's just a guy with a gun and a car. he's not supernatural, although there's theories about having some sort of abilities, but I tend to not go with those theories. He's just a guy, and that to me makes this infinitely more terrifying. It's based on, loosely based on real events. This could happen.
Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, he's an accomplished sharpshooter. He's obviously a hunter tracker, so he knows how to stalk his prey when it comes down to, you know, getting rid of vermin.
Definitely, and that's definitely what he sees non-Australians as. As we learned in the second movie.
Wait. So not all Australians?
Not all Australians.
Oh.
I don't think he's going to go back and take out the guys at the gas station.
Well, if he did, he'd be doing the world a favor.
He did. We'd like him even more. It's so bizarre to say. You know what? It's so bizarre to say that because he's such a horrendous character. Says the man who absolutely stands Michael Myers, you know, this guy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like, is it? I don't know. As a horror fan, I don't think it's that bizarre a thing to say. Okay, right. We must move on because we are now fast. We're fast approaching a very long run time for this episode.
It was just bonus content. We didn't know we were recording yet.
Absolutely. Oh wait, I forgot to hit record. No, I'm only joking. Let's move on to the next section. We're going to get into the ratings and our final thoughts. So, as always, we will start off with the critics' scores, and this will link back to what I was saying a little bit earlier about critics. Never trust a critic unless they're on the Behind the Screams podcast, okay? Because the critics hate horror movies, and they don't know what they're talking about. IMDb scored this movie a 6.2 out of 10. Metacritic scored it 54 out of 100. The Rotten Tomatoes critics scored it 53%. Although, having said that, the Rotten Tomatoes audience scored this just 49%. The critics' consensus, though Wolf Creek is effectively... I'll try that again. Though Wolf Creek is effectively horrific, it is still tasteless exploitation.
Okay.
I need a moment, okay? Because I'm kind of getting, right? And we know, as fans of horror, and as anyone who's listened to this podcast for any length of time, you know, you'll have heard me say it before, we all know that critics generally don't tend to like horror movies. They rate them far harshly. You see them always getting snubbed at, you know, major award shows and things like that. That was one of the reasons why we started up the Behind the Screams Horror Awards. Not that we're comparing ourselves to the Oscars in any way, shape, or form, but, you know, maybe one day. this whole opinion, these sort of publications, they get people who don't like horror movies to review horror movies, and it's just why even bother, you know. I saw it was actually on Twitter, someone it was something that sort of blew up, someone who was reviewing a horror movie, I can't remember which one, and they were writing this article for a newspaper or whatever it was at the time, a magazine, and in the very first sentence the author of the art, the publisher or whatever, he said, the very first sentence, he says, "I'm not a big fan of horror movies." And you're like, well, why the fuck are you reviewing this horror movie then?
It's like selling a vegan to rate this, like, really delicious veal parmesan, okay? Like, literally, why?
It's just insanity. And I feel like even if you don't like this movie, because not all horror movies are for everyone, you know, some people don't like certain styles. This one's almost got a found footage sort of vibe to it as well, because a lot of it was filmed on handheld cameras. Mm-hmm. And I know that's not for a lot of people as well. But you can't deny how effective, you know, John Jarrett was as Mick, how iconic Mick has become as this sort of horror villain, the brutality of this movie. Look, is this a perfect movie? No, I've raised a couple of criticisms. We've raised a couple of things, you know, around the pacing, around the flashing out of these characters. But is it as bad as what that sentence that I read out, that critic's consensus, though Wolf Creek is effectively horrific, it's still tasteless exploitation. It just dismisses the movie completely, and I'm not for that whatsoever.
It's very reductive language that obviously goes to show their attitude walking into it.
Yeah.
I mean, the actions, I feel, of certain characters, the words or values represented, you know, by certain characters certainly have been tasteless and problematic.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no arguing that, but I mean, no story, no effective storytelling is just going to show something that's all sunshine and rainbows. I mean, we want something that's real. And especially if we're talking about a horror movie where there's supposed to be something that really grips you and makes you uncomfortable at its core, I think it's been very effective.
Absolutely.
And also shines a light on the darkness of the mind. Mm-hmm. We talked about this a lot in Ma, where how somebody, you know, the personality might be there, the outward expression of this individual's identity is there,
yeah,
but manifests in such a dark and sinister way. And it can definitely highlight and bring to light the conversations that need to be had about people that manifest their positive traits as nothing more than a wedge or a manipulating bargaining piece, so to mm-hmm. speak, in this transaction of whatever is perceived like this chess game, you know, like, and everybody's a pawn in the game you're playing.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, linking this to Ma as well, very charismatic villain, very, you know, charming, you know, very, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? When she, you know, sort of puts herself in the friendship group, she becomes friends with these people, you know, and that's a very common link, like I was saying earlier, to things like serial killers, to things like mass murderers and stuff like that. So very, very, very clever. I got a bit passionate there about the critics' consensus, okay? I'm sorry, but this really grinds my gears, okay? So I do apologize. But, Jade, on a scale of 0 to 10, what will you rate Wolf Creek?
As you mentioned, it's not a perfect movie. The pacing in the beginning was kind of weird. I wanted to know more about like the characters themselves and the motives and what really drove them. I want to know more about Mick, for instance. It definitely left me hungry for understanding why. Uh-huh. So that and a couple of the story beats that just weren't really delivered upon, for instance, like the stopped watches. It just left some questions. So I have reservations in that regard. But it was effective enough of a story for me to want to go back for more. So with the criticisms in mind, I'm going to rate this an 8 out of 10.
8 out of 10. Excellent. So I have... We are pretty much in agreement around most of the points of this movie. You know, I had the same reservations as you had. I felt that the pacing of, especially specifically the first sort of act of this movie was rather funny. You know, we got this really long drawn out following of these three characters, you know, but it didn't really tell us anything about them other than two of them kind of fancy each other. And yeah, and but then once, like you say, things like, you know, the broken watches, and then we didn't really get any payoff to the fact that we've got these two characters who had this blossoming relationship that never really got any sort of resolution there. But when Mick is introduced to this movie, he just steals the show. Like, absolutely mm-hmm. steals the show. He's chewing the scenery. He is, you know, acting for the back rows. He is sensational, and I actually consider Mick to be one of my favorite horror villains of all time, you know, up there with the greats as well. He is a modern great in terms of horror villains, in my opinion. So just because, you know, I love this movie, I love the brutality of it, I love the sort of nuance and the fact that, you know, we really find out that Mick's a very, very smart character as well. He's not just this guy who kidnaps people and kills them and that's kind of it. You know, he stalks his prey. You know, he's very smart. He knows certain things. He seems like he's very knowledgeable about the world and stuff like that. And I love all those thoughts. So for me, all of that stuff really heavily outweighs the rest of those issues that we have at the start. Once you get past that first 40 minutes, the rest of this movie is pretty excellent, in my opinion. So I'm going to give this a 9 out of 10. I really, really do rate it that highly. I love this movie.
Okay. Oh, man. Wow. That was higher than I was expecting from you, Ian, and I am very pleasantly surprised.
I've developed this reputation for being a harsh critic myself. I'm out here really criticizing all these critics for being too harsh. And I'm the harshest critic on this show, you know? So, but no, I really do love this movie, and, you know, I will always be happy to watch this. And I'm really excited now that I've got access to season one of the TV show, that I can go and watch the two seasons. And when I was researching for this, also finding out that there's a Wolf Creek 3 on the way as well, so that's really excited me too. But
oh yes,
combining our scores with the critic scores, that gives Wolf Creek an average rating of 6.1 out of 10. Damn you, critics. It puts it in 52nd place on the list of movies that we have covered on the show. And get this, right? It has the exact same rating as two other movies we have previously covered on the show. The exact same rating as Sinister from 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And the exact same rating as Ma.
Wait, really?
Yes.
Oh my god. This could not have been better.
What a bizarre coincidence. You know what? That's just like the watches breaking. It's just actually this really bizarre coincidence.
Are we ever going to get a payoff on that one at least? I mean, come on.
You're never going to hear about this again.
Oh, god damn it. All right, we're going to have to schedule Wolf Creek 2. Can we do that? Like let's get that on the books like tomorrow, and so, then we can do our paranormal activity after that.
So next week on the show, we're going to be covering Wolf Creek. No, I'm but yeah, no, that's such a bizarre coincidence. I only just found out about that because obviously I don't know what we're gonna rate the movies before we start. So
that was
entirely dependent on me on you rating it an 8 and me rating it a 9.
Wow, I'm so okay with this. I'm so okay with this.
but that's our opinions on the movie. That's the critics. But what we want to know, and what we want to know in all of our listeners now, is what you think, the listeners. So, if you follow us on social media, you'll already know that we throw out on the day of recording or the day before recording, we'll throw out the opportunity for you guys, the listeners, to let us know your opinions on the movies that we are covering. And then, you know, we'll read some of them out on the show. I'll pick a few, I'll handpick 4 or 5, and we'll read them out on the show. So, let's go with it. So, the Once Upon a Nightmare podcast, they had this to say. They said, "This movie was great, and I really want to watch it again. Haven't been able to. It's so messed up, and I really want to watch the second one. Remote locations make a film just that bit more terrifying." I agree with them. And yeah, go if you can go watch the second movie as well. I'm sorry if I've spoiled it for you.
There's so much to unpack in Wolf Creek 2. To be honest, I mean, we could easily do another episode on that,
and we probably will.
And have so much to talk about just with that alone.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The Horror Project podcast. I remember this film absolutely scaring the shit out of me. I really need to go back and check it out again. This goes back to what I'm saying, that this is one of, you know, I'm sure you're a bit like me, that you're kind of desensitized to these things, you know, like, it's like watching Wookiee do our Spooky Saturdays, you know, he doesn't get jump scares. Trying to get him to jump scare him is a ridiculously difficult task. It's maybe not so difficult for me, but, you know, we're desensitized to the brutality of it. But this is still a genuinely scary film.
I've always had the fear of being chased or being like followed.
Yes.
That I don't like. But then, like, I've gone through the entire Saw series and seen like broken bones split through skin and people's heads get crushed in and stuff like that. Someone saw off his own foot, you know, like those things. I still, even then, when we had the scene with the head on a stick, okay, that still made me cringe. You know, I still crumpled up a little bit inside.
Absolutely.
Chilling.
Absolutely.
Chilling.
Previous guest host Sophie, yeah, you could check out her episode on Saw 3. She will be coming back onto the show. She said, "This film had me fucked up when I watched it as a teenager." That's pretty straightforward, Sophie, but I completely feel your sentiment. Andy Marshall on Twitter, "This film has ruined road trips for me, much like Jaws ruined swimming in the ocean." So, a comparison to Jaws, that's pretty high praise.
It's going to need a bigger boat.
It's going to need a bigger knife.
Oh. Well, Mick's got that. He's already got it.
And finally, just for a bit of balance, perhaps, Dr. Horror on Twitter. It takes a long, and he puts about 7 O's in there, a long time to get going, and wants you to care way more about its protagonist's romantic tension and road trip that I can muster. But the finale pays off. So they've obviously chosen to focus more on the fact that the pacing of the first portion of the movie, which we've obviously discussed about in a bit of detail as well, but agrees with us that the end of this movie especially is pretty fantastic. So thank you to everyone who interacted with us on social media. We're sorry that we didn't get to go through all of your responses to us, but please do keep responding to us. We try and mix it up and try and get different responses on, so we do try and read out as many as we can. But obviously, we don't want to spend, you know, half an hour reading out people's opinions on the show. I don't think that would make for a particularly good episode. But that's it. That's it for this week's show. Jade, thank you very, very much for coming back onto the show. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. I love the community here. I love seeing people interact with your posts, like on Twitter, for instance, getting to hang out in your streams on Twitch as well. And then just getting more and more plugged into the horror community as a whole has always been a very positive experience for me. Mm-hmm. And then getting to just talk about one of my favorite things. I mean, we're talking about horror, and being able to do that with somebody, across the world in the middle of a pandemic is such an amazing and enriching experience. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity. Thank you so much.
No, I always have such a pleasure talking, specifically about horror movies, but about the wider, you know, community that we're in as well, whether that's gaming, social media, COVID that we had a nice little discussion before we came on air.
Goddamn COVID.
God damn that Rona. But anything anything at all. So no, I really do appreciate you coming back onto the show. Hopefully we can get you and your good lady wife onto the show again in the future. But do you want to remind our listeners where they can find you on your social medias, where they can find your Twitch, and what you've been streaming?
Yeah, so you can find me anywhere Coyote Wildfire is, basically. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter. The Twitch handle is the same as well. I think the only thing that is different is just the fact that the invite to Discord is a random string of characters. But if you find me there, I'm live 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 11 p.m. for my UK folks, and that's 2 p.m. for the Pacific folks. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I typically stream things, indie, horror, roguelite, or RPG genre games. It depends on the game, but usually I'll see a game out and then, you know, put a new game in its rotation on a given day. We've been growing. It's been really crazy. We've had so many great people, that we've had the opportunity to meet, and no small share of that has been folks that we've also met through Behind the Screams and the horror community as well, which has been just extraordinary. And getting to have those people become not just supporters but friends. I mean, I've made lifelong friends thanks to Behind the Screams.
Well, that really does mean a lot to us, so thank you very much for those incredibly, incredibly kind words. I really do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Well, for you guys, the listeners, all the links that Jade has just mentioned, they will be in the description for this week's show. We'll also be publishing them across our social medias as well, so keep an eye out for those. And then if you are on Twitch at any of the times that Jade has just mentioned, go say hello to him, because you will not regret it. I can promise you that. Don't forget, though, you can find this show on Twitter at Screams Behind, Facebook and Instagram. Just search for Behind the Screams Podcast. You can find her Twitch channel at twitch.tv/Behind the Screams Podcast. We stream there every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, not Friday. I'll try that again. Monday, Wednesday, Saturday and Sunday. We have a mixture of Dave and myself doing those streams, where we stream a variety of horror video games, but we may in the future as well, specifically more when I finally get my potato of a PC upgraded, we may start streaming some non-horror stuff as well. I know Wookie has been working very, very hard to try and help me out with some better, better equipment, but he's the man in the know about these things. He's the man in the know. So yes, check us out across those. And if you would like to give us more support, or you would like to check out just more of content, we also have Patreon, patreon.com/behindthescreams. There we do bonus movie reviews. So for the month of February, you can get a bonus review of both Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat. I just forgot what we did. Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat, but we also do horrible history shows where we talk about this week in horror history, and we also discuss horror news as well. And at the end of each month, we do a special episode. So for the month of February, we will be doing a special retrospective on the careers of Sam Raimi and Samara Weaving, who are, of course, two of our Behind the Screams Horror Hall of Fame inductees for 2020. So you can go to patreon.com/behindthescreams and sign up from just £1 a month. Thank you to everyone who has already subscribed to us. If you're listening to this show, you obviously know who you are. Thank you so, so much. We really appreciate the fact that you are willing to part with your hard-earned pounds, dollars, whatever currency it is that you have. That we really, really do appreciate it. And, you know, we put that back into trying to make improvements to the show as well. So we thank everyone involved in that. But I know we've gone very long in this episode, but I do have a couple more pieces of housekeeping just to get through before we move on. This is obviously the final episode that's going to be released this month in February, and for the month of March, it's going to be very, very different. International Women's Day is on the 8th of March, and so for the entire month of March, we are going to be celebrating women in horror. So we are going to be doing female-led movies, female-directed movies, but not only that, all of our main shows will be hosted not by me. I will be relinquishing my power grip over the main host of this show. Lucy and Lindsay will be the main host of the show for the month of March. And so I'm very, very much looking forward to that. We are kicking off the month with Ginger Snaps, which is a movie that I'm very, very much looking forward to getting to grips with and getting to talk about. So there's going to be a slight difference to the show in this month, but it's going to be really, really cool. I'm very much looking forward to it. I hope you guys at home are looking forward to it as well. Jade, have you seen Ginger Snaps?
I have not seen Ginger Snap, no, although now I'm going to have to add that to my watch list.
Well, I must say, a slight spoiler for how the conversation is going to go, perhaps, but I highly recommend it. I highly, highly recommend it.
Duly noted. I just took a note of it in my notebook here where I was, you know, talking in my head, all my talking points and whatnot for the podcast.
Awesome. Last piece of housekeeping as well. So this podcast, the way we get our podcast out to you guys, the listeners, we obviously have to use a podcast host who distributes us to all of the various podcasting sites, like Apple Podcasts, like Spotify, and things like that. So we use a website called Buzzsprout. Buzzsprout, over the weekend, we are recording this on Tuesday the 23rd, over the weekend was hit with a DDoS attack. So it was basically a cyber attack where people was trying to crash their servers. So if you've had any issues trying to find us, trying to find our episodes or anything like that over the past few days, we think that the problem has now been rectified, but we are very, very sorry, of course, for any inconvenience that's caused anyone who's been trying to get hold of the show. It wasn't us that was removing the show. It wasn't the fault of Buzzsprout either. You know, they were hit by cyber criminals who are trying to get some money, but in the meantime are stopping a lot of podcasters from being able to do the things that they love and get their words out there for everyone to hear. So we do apologize if you've had any troubles getting a hold of the show over the past few days, but we think that the problem has now been rectified, and so moving forward everything should be hunky-dory. But that will definitely do it. I promise you guys who are listening, that is definitely it this time for the show. Jade, once again, thank you so, so much for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. Thank you to everyone at home who's downloaded and listened to this episode. We really appreciate you too. And we hope you will join us next time on Behind the Screams.